Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. And you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world's changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will probably be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm excellent. I hope you are as well, because we don't have a safety net tonight. It's just you and I, buddy.
It is pure, live, unscripted, no guests. This is, I remember like the second or third podcast we ever did, second or third Fast Forward Radio we ever did, I remember we took the scripts away and all that stuff, and we still weren't sophisticated enough to have guests. And I believe you even called it Fast Forward Radio Unplugged.
That's right.
You remember that?
Well, our first couple of shows, we thought we had to script every word we said. So we literally sat there and wrote out, like, you know, page after page of stuff that we would sit there and read on the air. Well, you know, what we ended up having as far as a radio show at that point kind of, well, wasn't great. It sounded like we were reading, and we found after we said, oh, to heck with this, let's just talk. It turned into a better radio show after that. I mean,
well,
the quality
went up. Well, it turned into a radio show at that point.
Yeah, at that point you got a, you know, a couple of guys actually saying what's on their mind instead of just reading a script. You know, we could just publish our script and on a blog, and that'd be, you know, just as good. So, yeah, it made podcasting real for us after we did that.
Yeah, absolutely. It made a huge difference. So tonight we're kind of going back to those days. You know, it's an acoustic set because we've just finished our 10-part, 11-week series, The World Transformed. Started back in June and ran all the way through September, kind of laying the groundwork, kind of stepping back and setting the stage for really everything we talk about on Fast Forward Radio, everything we talk about at The Speculist, in terms of the major transformations that the world is facing today. And
can I tell you, in hindsight, I mean, really, I got to give you the credit, Phil, because this was your idea, this whole series, and I thought you were biting off more than we could chew, quite frankly. Running a series, you know, that long and having that many guests and everything, you know, we'll never pull it off. Well, just week after week, awesome guests every week, and I got to give you credit. You're the one that went out and got these folks, and so way to go, man.
Well, thanks.
Hats off,
Stephen. I thought it was tremendous fun, and what made it all come together was just these awesome folks we had on the show. I mean, that's really what it was. That some of the leading. Well, actually, the leading people in just any number of subjects. I mean, these 10 subjects, really, that we talked about. We had world authorities on these subjects, and so generous with their time, and really flexible with us, and willing to just, you know, spend the time and talk with us and with our audience about these things. It's just been a tremendous experience. It was, I think is the most fun we've had with this program since we've started it, actually.
No doubt, and you know, aim high, I guess, is the motto, is to what to take away from this. But I guess the thing to do, I don't know how we're going to be able to cover, 10 weeks or 10 parts, but let's do our best to kind of look back at these subjects, I guess.
Well, here's what I thought we would do, because you're right, it would be beyond what we're going to be able to fit into an hour. We're back to an hour format this evening with no guests, just the two of us talking. That seemed more more in keeping, and that is the normal length of the show. So so tonight will be an hour, and for the foreseeable future will be an hour until we get talking about something and we take it to an hour and a half as we've done in the past. But what I thought we'd do, Stephen, is we'll just go through these, and for each one, if you had a major takeaway, you know, if for a particular topic you say, here's one thing I really got out of that, one thing I'd really like to share about that, or if you think, well, here's something we related to that topic that we never even touched that we probably should. So those are kind of the parameters. We're not going to try to, you know, recap everything. We're not going to try to summarize, what was it, 15, 16 and a half hours worth of programs in 1 hour. We'll touch on what got our attention and what we think is worthy of exploring further.
Absolutely.
How's that for parameters?
Yeah, there we go. Not bad thinking. So I guess the first one is going back to the first week, and the title of that show is Our Thinking Transformed, Imagination, Creativity, and a World Transformed. So you got any major takeaways from that?
Well, you know, that was the one where we just kind of wanted to set the stage. We wanted to say, well, let's prepare ourselves mentally for this challenge that we're taking on in doing this program. And I think if I could take anything away from that, it's just the idea that we really have to be nimble in our thinking. That our thinking has to be quicker than it's been in the past. It has to be broader, because we have so much more that we can possibly take in, so much more demanding of our attention. And I think probably the biggest thing of all is that we have to be open to possibilities that are different. We have to be open to ideas that are very different from ideas that we've contended with before. This fits in, I think, greatly with the notion of the human imperative. And the idea that humanity is this process of solving problems, this process of improving the world around us, making it better incrementally, working our way towards eventually someday the optimum configuration of the universe. The way you get there is by trying new things. And the way you try new things is by being able to imagine new things. And the way you make yourself able to imagine new things is by not closing things off, right? It's by not having a lot of rigid rules about, well, I can think about this, but I can't even think about that, right? Not to say that there isn't badness in the world, or that there aren't things that are a total waste of time to think about, but that you have to start with a pretty broad and a pretty expansive view of things, and you have to keep it pretty broad and pretty expansive if you're going to find the real opportunities to move us forward. So that would be my major takeaway, I think.
I would just add to that it pays to be humble. Don't get married to any one ideology too closely, because our sacred cows are going to be slaughtered in the coming years, I believe. And so, you know, if it turns out that something, you know, let's say you're a college professor and you're teaching X, well, and then you learn that, well, that doesn't really apply anymore, you know, then just be willing to, okay, let's move on. You know, I might have spent half my career teaching something that just wasn't correct or is no longer applicable or whatever, but let's go to the next thing. And I think it would pay to be humble.
Well, and as we observed on the blog earlier today, or I guess yesterday I put that up, you can now go back to college for $99 a month. So
that is so awesome. I you know, when this topic was originally suggested by Michael, his idea was that we would talk about how education needs to change in the future, and I think that's a big part of it. I think that what we're going to see is less, you know, people less and less are going to be willing to spend half their career paying back student loans.
Right.
There's got to be a better way. There's got to be a better model, and I think that, you know, things like, if not necessarily the, you know, $99 a month online learning, I don't know that that'll take the place of all college learning. I wouldn't suggest that, but I think things like that and as revolutionary as that, that's going to be the way we've got to go.
Well, and one reason we have to go that way is because the ground keeps shifting under us. So if you're a professor and your specialty suddenly disappears and you need to go back to school, you need a nimble, economical, quick way of changing your specialty or refocusing that or whatever that would be. And I think we all potentially face that, needing to get up to speed on new technologies, needing to learn new techniques, new approaches. And a lot of this happens ad hoc. People learn Facebook and Twitter, and we incorporate all this social media and all these new things into our lives. I just got my iPhone today. Okay.
So oh, man, you're going to love that.
I'm trying to catch up with you, trying to keep up with Steven.
I'm going to tell you, it will take you like a week, and then you'll realize, I'm never going back. I'm never going to have anything less than this again. This is the new normal, because you're going to get, being able to, and just think of it this way, how wonderful Google is when you're sitting at your computer,
Right.
Now you've got Google with you everywhere, and exactly. it really will be a part of your brain, as I've argued for years. It's the new way of being, a new way of thinking. So, yeah, it's the new normal for you from here forward. I really predict.
Yeah, absolutely, it is. And the thing is, as we adopt all this informally, I think we're also going to find new ways to become formally schooled, to become credentialed, and to be able to take on new things that much more quickly too, just because we have to, because everything, the world is accelerating that fast, so our thinking has to accelerate. Okay, let's move on to the second one. We do want to try to hit all 10 before the hour is up. So the next one is the end of aging and the coming era of indefinite lifespan. So, Stephen, any big takeaways you had on that, or things that we...
Well, this was our second time to get to talk to Aubrey de Grey, and I just got to say to other podcasters out there, if you haven't talked to Aubrey de Grey and you would like to, ask, the man is very, very gracious with his time, and he's just a really good sport about spending some time with guys that admittedly don't know too much about this, and try to bring us along and try to educate us. So he's a great guest.
Yeah, he really is. And what I like about the two guests that we had talking about that, because we had Aubrey on
for
the second time, and we had Dr. Terry Grossman on.
Yeah, the following week, I believe, wasn't it?
It was actually, we talked to them on separate weeks, but we played Aubrey's recording and talked to Terry live on the same show. So
Yeah, that's right.
From the audience's standpoint, we talked to them both the same night. And what's interesting, the contrast between those two, Aubrey, who gives us the very clear path whereby these problems can be solved, human lifespan can be extended indefinitely, and Dr. Terry Grossman with this extremely compelling message that, yeah, that's all true, and you can start today.
Yeah.
Right? There are things you can do. And if I had not a regret about that show, just if there were more time, and maybe we'll have Dr. Grossman on again, I feel like we might have given a little bit of a short shrift to we asked him what are the things you can do now, and he gave us some good suggestions for how you start. But I think my response to that might have come off as a little dismissive. It might have sounded a little bit like I didn't think that that was terribly substantive, and of course that's not fair to ask somebody for three quick things and then turn around.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you didn't
sound like much.
Yeah, he did the best he could with the time we gave him.
Yeah, exactly. So hopefully
he did remarkably well. So
we can get him back on and maybe spend a full hour getting into what it is that they do at his clinic. It's right here in the Denver area in Colorado, and he is seriously working with patients on working with them from where they are now to extend their lives. The idea being to build bridges for people between now and the time when the kinds of treatments that Aubrey de Grey is talking about, between now and the time that those treatments kick in and people are able to take advantage of those. So it's a very valuable thing that he's doing, and I think it probably deserves more attention than we were able to give it that night.
I was disappointed about one thing I learned, and it was just something factual that Aubrey de Grey kind of set us straight on. The fact that he believes that in order to get any kind of serious life extension, we're going to have to solve all seven problems that he has pointed out. That seemed almost discouraging to me because, frankly, some of these problems are pretty tough.
It's true. Yeah, you were hoping, I certainly was hoping he would say, well, if we get just these two, we're 60% of the way there, right?
But yeah,
you really got to have all seven before it does any good.
Yeah, if we solve this one problem, that grants you 10 years, and, you know, then that gives us time to solve this next problem, which will give you 20, and, you know, things, you know, it doesn't work like that.
Right.
You know, if it's one of these deals where all seven of them, any one of the seven will kill you, you know, within a certain period of time. So even if you solve number one problem completely, it won't be. It might not be number one that kills you. It'll be number two that kills you about the same time. So,
right.
You know, it's kind of a. That's the situation. So, any rate,
I guess it's kind of. Like, it's probably kind of like baking a cake.
Yeah, you can't. If you don't have all seven ingredients,
we've got the
flour
and the milk. We don't have the eggs and the shortening, right? What do you?
Yeah, that's right. What do you mean I can't bake a cake? I've got eggs and
I've got sugar,
and that should be good enough.
Yeah, you get a nice quiche or something. Yeah,
if it turns out you got to have all seven. So anyway,
yeah, you have to have all seven to achieve sins, to achieve the real cure for aging. But there definitely are things incrementally that can be done, and that's where Terry Grossman's work comes in. So I think there is an incremental approach, and then there is a complete cure for aging approach. So
they can be hand in hand, and so that's good. Hopefully, Terry Grossman's approach will buy us enough time to get to Aubrey de Grey's approach. So
that's the idea.
That's the idea.
Okay, what's next?
Nanotech revolution. It was we had an entire nanotech show. I think that was about week number three. So.
You know, I would comment, two comments I would make about nanotechnology is how foundational it is to some of the other transformations that we talk about. I got to thinking about this as I was going through the list.
Absolutely. There's nothing that we talk about in this 10 weeks that would not be impacted by nanotech.
Exactly. And the impact that technology will have on our world just touches everything. But the two that particularly, I think, depend on or derive a good deal of leverage, I should say, from our first, our discussion about the end of material scarcity. Because it's really, once we have nanotechnology-driven material replication, that the age of abundance truly can kick in. So nanotechnology is a big driver for that one. When we got to that topic, an awful lot of what we were talking about there really depends on nanotech.
Right.
Then I would just say, though,
that, I mean, you know, the science of the very, very small is where it's at. I mean, you know, for computers, for life extension, overcoming the risks that we see coming down the pipe in the future. I mean, literally everything we talked about, you know, keeping the computer revolution going after Moore's law, you know, it's all part of it.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's the connections between nanotechnology and these other transformations, I think, are unavoidable. And to me, the other big one is where when nanotechnology meets artificial intelligence. That's when the world really starts getting wacky, okay? Because right, that's when you get, you know, flying cars, utility fog. I mean, that's when you reach an age where just about anything you can imagine can be manifested in the real world, the way we talk about just about anything you can imagine very soon will be able to manifest in virtual worlds. Well, here we're talking about the ability to make just about anything happen, and it depends upon the realization of nanotechnology. Then you marry that to the artificial intelligence, and you've got a truly transformed world. You've got a world where essentially magic is possible at that point, to use a highly incendiary and controversial word. But I really think that's the level of change we're talking about once those two technologies both come online and meet, right? Where they merge is the singularity, I think.
Right, right. Arthur C. Clarke's law. I was invoking something I didn't have the name to. Sorry.
Arthur C. Clarke. Yeah. What was it he said, that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic?
That's right. So, yeah. And that's exactly what we're talking about.
See, so it's okay that I said magic because Arthur
C.
Clarke.
Yeah,
thank you for reminding me. You know,
so
people argue with me, I'll say take it up with Arthur C. Clarke. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not crazy, or maybe I'm just as crazy as Arthur C. Clarke. So.
Yeah, crazy like Arthur C. Clarke, thank you. Okay, so next, moving along here, I think we're tracking just about right here.
Yeah.
We talked about risks and dystopia and unsettling futures. So this was a little unfair.
This was our downer show of the,
well,
of the series.
That was a downer show, but actually I think to be true to my math, because the formula that I have laid out, the Pareto analysis that I've laid out, is that for all of human history, we've been focused 80% on survival and not dying and not getting eaten, and 20% on trying to make incrementally good things happen. And that we're now at the point where that needs to shift, and we need to spend 80% of our time on going after the good stuff and 20% of our time trying not to get eaten by saber-toothed tigers or, you know, whatever the 21st century equivalent of that would be. In fact, we should have done two shows on risks, dystopia, and unsettling futures for it to be the full 20%.
Yeah, we only used 10%.
So,
or less if you count the fact that our 10th part was two shows long. So
exactly. So I, yeah. Percentage-wise, I think I was unfair to the negative stuff. But from a standpoint of putting together a really good group of folks talking about it and interesting, compelling discussion on that subject, I don't think we could have done any better.
No, absolutely not. Those guys were awesome. It was so funny because, you know, often we feel like we need to jump in and you know, help our guests along. Not so much with the guests in this series, but it happens. And you know, pretty much on that show, it was, what do you guys think? And we could be silent the rest of the time because they could
go
they
grab
had
a cup
lot.
Of coffee. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I join the chat room and listen in because those guys had so much to say. And obviously had thought so much about it, and we're very glad to be in one another's company because, you know, they're always reading each other's stuff, and so it was kind of a fun show for that purpose as well. So,
absolutely, yeah, it was a great show. And by guys, of course, there was a woman too.
We're
using the term generic.
Yeah, generically, yes, absolutely.
Any particular dystopic futures that? That stand out in your mind from that one? Any ideas about that?
Every time the subject comes up, I feel like we got to mention Moore's Law for mad scientists.
Mm.
And
Now you brought it up. What is that?
Okay. Well, you know what Moore's Law is. It's that every 18 months we get a doubling of computer power because, you know, the amount of we're able to put more and more, you know, transistors in a smaller and smaller space, and so the calculations speed up. And so that's Moore's Law. Moore's Law for mad scientists says that every 18 months, the IQ of a potential world-killing mad genius drops, you know, drops by what? How many points?
1 point, yeah.
One point.
So we're quickly moving in on the era when just the average Joe is able to destroy the world.
Yeah, and you know, there might be a few average Joes that would like to, and so that's kind of a scary dystopic future. So obviously, you know, what I'm hoping for, one thing, you know, you have people like Bill Joy, who published the famous article a few years ago now, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. And it was, you know, really a dystopic look at the future, saying, you know, basically the machines are going to take over and, you know, we're going to be rendered to the ash heaps, basically. But, I guess my point, my response, and his response was that what we got to do is we got to relinquish technology. We can't, you know, obviously, if we really want to survive, if we really want to, we got to give up computers. The way I guess Japanese society gave up firearms for samurai culture or something, I guess, is his idea there. My thought is the exact opposite. In order to, you know, there's always going to be mad geniuses, and there's always going to be somebody out there that's going to continue the research. If all the good people in the world gave up computers and, you know, went back to living like the Amish or whatever, there would still be some people out there that would be advancing this technology, and we would be defenseless to it. And so my thought is the exact opposite of what Bill Joy would suggest. We got to put our foot to the accelerator, and therefore we develop the defenses to the mad geniuses, as you know, at the same time, and so we can have a fighting chance.
Absolutely. Well, and I think the other thing where this particular show kind of synced up with some of the others, one is John Smart. Last week and the week before, talking about the tremendous defense systems or immune systems that seem to come along for the ride with convergence and with acceleration, that not only do our capabilities become more robust, but our ability to withstand attacks from the outside, attacks from the inside, seem to become more robust. It seems to be part of the whole process, which I think that, as stated, Moore's Law for mad scientists doesn't capture, because that's also Moore's Law for would-be, you know, James Bond superhero people to save the world types, right? It's working both ways. The other connection that I would make between that show and the other shows is it goes back to the first one, because truly, how we think has a lot to do with whether or not we can survive the risks that we face, because it's not necessarily the ones that we're looking at and thinking about that are going to get us. We have to be aware of the ones that we're not looking at and that we're not thinking about. And again, that goes back to this idea of expanding our view of what's possible and what might happen. And I think it was Sonia Arison who made a really good point to that effect, that dealing with these risks has as much to do with expanding our focus and trying to anticipate new possible outcomes as it does thinking, well, we got a 0.00001% chance of a meteor strike, but it's a 0.001 of global warming or whatever. It's not just calculating the odds on all the things we thought about. It's imaginatively engaging what could arise out of what we haven't thought about yet.
The known knowns, the known unknowns. Yeah. All right, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. Don't bring it up if you can't do it, man.
I can't do it. Okay.
Yeah. It's the unknown knowns. The known. I don't know. Something.
I can't pull it off. I tell you what. I'll link to someone who can.
There you go.
In
fair
the
enough.
Show notes or something. Okay. All right. I guess our next show was reworking the human architecture.
Right. Now that was. That was a fun one, just because what an eclectic group we put together to talk about that. We had PJ on, we had Are You Serious on, and I think Michael Anisimov was our other panelist that week, if I'm not mistaken.
Did we have Natasha Vitamori on that same show, or was that a different show?
No, she was on the show we did about education. About
okay.
our think transformer. Excuse me, it's Brian Wong who was
such a, yeah, it's such a rich show, 10 weeks, 11 weeks, hard to keep up. But yeah, okay. What did you take away from the human architecture show?
Well, the idea that sticks out in my mind from that one is the just one idea that I walked away with was all the controversy about designer babies and the kind of lack of controversy about designer adults.
Yeah.
That we're all fine with once you're grown up and you're out in the world, you can pretty much, it's a blank canvas. You can do anything you want to with it. But, of course, it's harder to get the bang for the buck with an adult formed organism than it is with a forming organism or one that hasn't even been formed yet. And so that's why there's this desire to make genetic modifications in the process of conceiving children. And
yeah.
That one, I think, will continue to be a controversy. I think that there will continue to be arguments about it, but ultimately it is destined for the dustbin of history. I think that, as we've talked about before, Stephen, that ultimately it's the soccer moms who will win that argument, and parents are going to have any advantage that they can provide for their children.
Yeah, ultimately that's what's going to win out. Think about it this way. If you ever watch an old 1930s movie or something showing an orphanage or young kids running around, invariably, like one of the group, of urchins running the streets would have their face tied up with like swollen out on the side, showing that, they got an abscessed tooth or something. And,
right.
And, think about also things like we used to see, like when I was a kid, some of my peers would have like full-blown pizza face. You know what I'm talking about with
absolutely,
things like that.
Yeah.
When was the last time you saw that on a kid? Nowadays, if you get a zit or two, your parents haul you off to the dermatologist, and you go to the dentist to head off these abscessed tooth and teeth and various things like that.
Sure.
So I mean, we, you know, as healthcare advances, we do what we need to do, and we take care of our kids. Well, you know, it's going to be that
way. And everything
way.
You just described, I would point out, is just cosmetic. I mean,
yeah.
I shouldn't say just because it's hugely important.
Well, yeah, it's not cosmetic to the kid that's got his face wrapped up.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just cosmetic. If you know, the difference between having severe acne and not is of unspeakable value to a teenager, and would be to most adults too, I think, actually.
Absolutely,
but,
yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to break you off from your train of thought, but to say that how much more so for things that actually impact the health and the likelihood that someone will live a longer life, they'll not be in pain, that they won't suffer symptoms. I mean, so as soon as you're talking about eliminating diseases, or you're talking about improving things like vision, hearing, intelligence, you know, that stuff is it's just bound to happen, I think.
I think that families that have things in their genetic history like Huntington's disease, very, you know, real tragic disease where people just, you know, in their 30s, they just, you know, slowly lose their minds, you know. It's and you know, there's nothing that you can do about it at this time. So what if with a little genetic modification we can ensure that babies that are born will not have that problem? Well, I can assure you that any family that's got Huntington's disease and have seen family members, you know, go down with that would absolutely take advantage of that technology. And so that you're going to see things like that happen first, and then slowly it'll move on to other modifications that are maybe not so, you know, profound. So
absolutely,
it'll happen. And you know, so and those who would be against it will ultimately come out, you know, be characterized, well, you're for people having Huntington's. You're arguing for things like that if you're arguing against any genetic modification in utero. So I think that argument will be won quickly once the technology is available. The thing is, we wring our hands over things we can't do until we can do them, and then we get pragmatic.
And then it has an amazing way of sorting itself out, doesn't it?
That's right. Sort of like test tube babies, you know.
Yeah.
We get used to the technology pretty quick once we have it and it's safe. So
I think you're right. Yeah. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Phil and Stephen working our way through the list of the 10 major transformations that are occurring in our world. And if you're listening live, please join us in our chat room. Our chat host, Sally Morham, is leading the chat. Forgot to introduce you earlier, Sally. Thanks for taking over for Michael this evening. And if you're listening to us via MP3, please leave a comment at blog.speculus.com. Okay, so our next program was on achieving friendly artificial intelligence. This was a big one. This was a tremendous show. We had James Hughes, Eliezer Yudkowsky, and Ben Gertzel on the show. So interesting kind of variety of perspectives with Ben and Ellie both representing kind of the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence view, although certain differences between the two of them. And then James over there from the Institute of for Ethics and Emerging Technologies with kind of a almost kind of a critique into the SIAI view of how friendly AI can be accomplished. That was a great discussion, I thought, and a really fun show.
And while they disagreed, they were obviously very, very respectful of one another's opinions on these issues. So it really was a great show.
It was a lot of fun getting into that topic with the ability to bounce the ideas around a little bit rather than just kind of having a rote recital of you know what the correct path forward would be. Now, what stands out in my mind from that discussion is, well, two sides of the same coin. It's the risks that are associated with getting AI wrong, so getting unfriendly AI.
Right.
Or getting friendly AI that just doesn't know how to be nice or, you know, some horrible. I'm not sure if we even need to define that as friendly. And the tremendous upside of getting it right.
Yeah.
Because along with nanotechnology, friendly artificial intelligence is the driver for so much of what we're talking about. And truly, the singularity is the moment or the events that occur after the moment when greater than human intelligence is achieved. So much of what we talk about with Ray Kurzweil and with John Smart all hinges on that discussion, on everything that that comes out of the efforts that are going on right now, groups like, well, I shouldn't say groups like Singularity Institute, because I don't know of any others that are very much like them, but for example, the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence, working to find a way to get us to friendly artificial intelligence. I should say there is at least one other group, which would be Ben's company, Novamente, which is working on that problem as well.
Absolutely. I had had something I wanted to say about it. I'm sorry, Phil. I'm going to have to throw it back at you for just a second while I collect my thoughts on that.
No problem. Well, I one of the things that is really exciting about the whole discussion of friendly artificial intelligence is how much airplay it's getting now.
Oh, yeah.
That the idea of the singularity has, what with the introduction of Singularity University and just a kind of a spreading out of these concepts into the popular culture, people are starting to engage this idea, and they're really starting to think about what it will mean for us to get there. People have thought about it from the other side, I think, for a long time, and because popular culture has given us the Matrix.
Yeah.
It's given us the Terminator movies, and it's given us Battlestar Galactica. So we've had these nightmare scenarios of unfriendly AI and the hard takeoff singularity and artificial intelligence appearing on the scene, which is hostile towards humanity.
Yeah, we've obviously have a great capacity for envisioning that kind of dystopia. I mean, we imagining monsters is not hard for us. So.
Well, it's really interesting. When you think back on science fiction, I remember reading in Isaac Asimov's Science Fiction magazine back in the 70s when he first started publishing his own title. In one of the early issues, he set out some editorial guidelines for stories that he would accept. And one of them was, and this is 30-plus years ago, 35 years ago probably, one of them was, no computers taking over the world. And, you know, why? Why didn't he want to do that? Because it had been done to death already 30
yeah.
years ago. Probably 50 years ago it had already been done to death. That once we had this idea of thinking machines becoming more powerful, the obvious immediate scenario that people went to with that was, oh, end of the world. Evil
yeah.
machine takes over. It wasn't until the 90s, I don't think, that anyone ever came up with the, hey, what if a really nice thinking machine took over the world? I mean, not that.
It's a little bit like the alien movies of the 50s. They were always take us to your leader, and then they take over the world kind of thing. It wasn't until 1981 or so that we got E.T. You know,
exactly.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind was just right before that. So, I mean,
yeah,
even,
exactly.
We always imagine the nicer possibility second. You know, we skip straight to the dangerous possibility. But that doesn't mean that the dangerous possibility is not really dangerous. So, I'm glad to have the Singularity Institute doing what they're doing and Novamente as well. Hey, I do remember what I was going to say. And I
okay.
actually am, by flaking out just a minute ago, I demonstrated the problem.
Oh, cool. awesome.
Getting the human brain upgraded, according to our panel that week, is going to be harder than producing artificial intelligence. We have so
I'm
much.
Sorry, say that again.
Human uplift, you know, basically upgrading our brains to greater than human intelligence would be harder, according to our panel that week, than actually building artificial intelligence.
Oh, okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
And the problem, you know, is obviously we. It's hard to hack into the system we have, and we have lots of native code that's really weird, and so that hacking the human brain could be a tougher nut to crack than artificial intelligence, and so
well, and
we better pray for friendly artificial intelligence, I guess is the point.
Yeah, well, we've got to. It's the thing you have to get right the first time.
Yeah, exactly.
Because
you're
if
not
you have
a second
singularity
shot,
and it's not friendly, there's not much of a chance you're going to get a second shot at that. That's right, depending on what the unfriendly AI does. I mean, if it's indifferent and it goes away, great. But that's only one possibility and not the most likely possibility of what an unfriendly AI does. Actually, we revisited that issue a couple weeks later when we had Ray Kurzweil on the show, and not so much in our conversation with Ray, but in our follow-up, as we were talking amongst ourselves afterwards, this question had come up in the chat room. So it sounds like Kurzweil thinks that the only way to get to AI is to model the human brain. In fact, that's not true. Kurzweil thinks that all other things failing, that's how we'll get there.
Right.
But that there are much more likely paths of getting there first. And, in fact, Ben Goertzel's company, Novamente, is working on building models that incrementally work towards artificial intelligence that are not reverse-engineered brains or anything of that sort. Clearly, a reverse-engineered brain would be the first step you would need in order to do human uplift. I mean, that would give you the template for getting there. But how much quicker we could get there if we could just build an AI from more or less whole cloth who could then figure out how to reverse engineer a human brain and take care of the problem for us. That's the easy answer, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, how do you uplift a human brain? Well, first you make a greater than human intelligence.
Right. Actually, that's how you solve any problem.
Yeah, that's right.
That's just a good general fix. Okay, let's move quickly on to virtual worlds and the future of personality. Any particular thoughts on that show, Stephen?
Well, my thought with virtual worlds has always been, you know, if everyone has the opportunity of, you know, basically living in their own personally designed heaven, does that mean that civilization as we know it is over? Do we all stay home in our virtual realities enjoying the good life rather than doing anything productive? I don't think so. I think that as a species, we love, you know, pleasure, certainly, but we also enjoy doing things productive. And so I don't think that that's necessarily the way it's going to go.
Yeah, I think Scott Adams, actually, in his book, The Dilbert Future, has this great chapter on Star Trek and talks about all the things that are wrong with Star Trek technology and why the future won't be anything like Star Trek. But the holodeck is his main point of contention. And he makes the argument in The Dilbert Future that the holodeck will be the last invention in human history, that human history stops with the invention of full immersion VR, because once we have that, right, we all go into the holodeck and we're all in there with virtual, you know, take your pick, Angelina Jolie, you know, whoever it would be for you. And that's it. Humanity ends because we go down this basically pleasure cycle of destruction. But I agree with you completely. I think that technology will unleash a huge amount of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it's the kid in the candy store.
Yeah.
After
a while, you get tired of that, and you're ready to do something else.
People have things that they enjoy that are available to them, and they don't wreck their lives with them. I mean, some people do. Some people are addicted to food, or there are alcoholics, there are drug addictions. Those things do occur, but that's not what happens to most people.
Yeah.
And even though those things are available, we find that we get more meaning out of our lives by not just indulging ourselves in those to the distraction of everything else, to the absence of everything else. And there's no reason, I think, to believe that that'll be any different, even when you offer this, what seems to us from this side of the looking glass, to be unbelievable pleasure and unbelievable temptation. I think that it won't look that way once you're there. It'll look like, well, yeah,
been there, done that.
But
yeah,
exactly. And people will move on to the next challenge.
Yeah, I would hope so. Yeah, I guess that was the biggest thing I took away from that show.
Yeah, the other thing is that I just wrote about this the other day. Today we only live in one world, but that's likely to change very soon. Externally, we have our internal worlds and we read fiction and that sort of thing, but we really only live in this world, and we have kind of a virtual world that we experience things in, but it's not the same level of experience. But that's going to change, and we will actually experience the world in as compelling and real a fashion within the virtual world as we do outside of the virtual world. And today we're starting to interact with beings from other levels of reality via games. So you have characters in games who are, in a sense, inhabitants of these budding new worlds. But that's going to get a lot more interesting, and it's going to become a lot more challenging when I think it's not that long before this begins to happen, that those beings, those characters living inside those worlds, when they have their own intentions and their own desires and their own sense of self, that's going to be an interesting and very challenging world. Not something we got into very much on the on the show when we talked about it, and I think I'd like to bring some of those folks back one of these days and get into that a little bit. How do we interact with people, we'll call them people, from different levels of reality? And it has potential even greater meaning for us because we might one day encounter the designers of the computer simulation we're living in, assuming that...
assuming that we are, yeah.
That ever turns out to be the case.
Well,
so,
and what are the, yeah, what are the ethics of it? Do we, you know, do we have the right to abuse, for example, beings from other levels of reality? So, yeah, it's, you know, you got huge issues associated with that kind of thing.
Right, because right off the bat, you would say, well, no, of course you don't. But then
well,
you would say, well, of course
you can you turn off your computer?
It?
You know, I mean,
yeah,
you have to leave your computer on indefinitely because there's this.
You don't
want to
kill them.
Yeah.
Well, or you don't want to, you know, put monsters in to eat them or something like that. But then you look at this world and you go, well, if this is a simulation, they're certainly not being very nice to us. Right? So.
Well, I could imagine a worse reality. So, you know.
Certainly. Okay, I'm not complaining if anybody.
Yeah, that's right. Knock on wood or whatever you need to do over there.
You did a fine job. But yeah, I think those are issues that bear further exploring. We'll make that another one of our programs coming up. Okay, the next show we did was on the end of scarcity and the coming era of abundance. And I think we've touched on this a little bit so far this evening just in talking about the important role that nanotechnology has to play.
Absolutely.
In bringing that about. One of the things that's really interesting about that discussion is, one of the things I took away from that is that it's not so much really a question of whether we get to abundance. The big question is how we get there. The big question mark, because we can picture the world as it is now, and we can picture the world as it will be when there's no scarcity.
Right.
But the roadmap that gets, you know, the incremental stepping stones that get us from here to there become a puzzle, and it gets very much bogged down. So, Stephen, you were talking about people holding on to existing ideologies and existing expectations about how things have to work. I think those can really bog us down
right.
in terms of making the leap to that next stage.
One of the things that John Smart talked with us about in our second to last show of the series was that I asked the question, I mean, do our ideas about the future, our limited ideas about the future, do they sometimes hold the future at bay? I mean, do we keep, you know, great things from happening because we have such a limited understanding? And his answer was absolutely we do. It happens, you know, happens all the time. If we were creative enough in our thinking, we were open-minded enough to, you know, question, you know, the way we do things, that we might, that we could bring about the future much quicker in so many ways, but we don't. And so sometimes we're dragged kicking and screaming into the future. But it happens.
And this is a particularly hard one because getting your head around non-scarcity is one of the trickiest ideas ever. So much of how our economy works, our sense of ethics works, just our picture of how the world is supposed to work is based on this idea of, well, there's not enough, and you got to struggle, and you have to work, and you got to, you know, I mean,
you got to fight for your piece of the pie, buddy, or, you know, you're not going to get it.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, I guess the idea, to give members of our audience who might not have heard the show an idea of what we're talking about, we're talking about a future maybe where there's a nanofactory, where it's the idea that, you know, all you really need in this world is dirt and sunlight. You know, sunlight to run our nanofactories, dirt as the raw material, and then and then you just tell it what it wants and it spits it out, you know. In a future like that, you know, you just, the idea of scarcity just kind of fades away for most things. There'll be a few things that will remain scarce, and what will remain scarce is also interesting.
Well, it is. You look at things like attention that remains scarce. Getting the attention of others will still be something that people might have to contend for. The economy might be based on reputation, as we've talked about before. We don't really know. I mean, that's one very interesting guess as to how it might work. It could be that in that world you've got AIs paying attention to you, and you say, I don't care if other people pay attention to me or not. And it could be that there's no scarcity of attention either. But then it could be human attention, right? Where people decide, well, authentic interaction with human beings—that's the real scarcity. That's the real thing that drives the economy. Kind of hard to imagine what those what those scarcities will be. But I agree with you that, that there will be scarcities, even in a post-scarcity world, even in a world of abundance. But what won't be scarce is food, shelter, clothing, and independence. People having the liberty to do whatever it is that they want to do with their lives and with their time. And,
right.
and that's what makes that world so radically different from the one that we live in now.
Absolutely. Real estate will remain scarce.
That's true, but it won't matter as much. But you're right.
Well, yeah. If you could always go to a virtual reality and live in any place you wanted, then I guess not. But
yeah.
Oh well. it's a diverse future we're thinking about.
For sure. Okay. So next, we talked with Ray Kurzweil about the technological singularity. So that was one. Unfortunately, Stephen, you didn't get to participate in the interview. So as a listener, an impartial witness of that, what's your takeaway? I'll give it to you first.
Ray's cool.
Yeah. Ray is awesome, man.
He's awesome. We love Ray.
We do.
I tell you, it's probably better I wasn't on the show. I would have just sat there in awe, and asked
stupid questions.
Gotten
all starstruck, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That would probably have been how it would have went. So maybe it was better I wasn't on the show. His ideas are really what was the driving force for me to become, interested in these kind of ideas. First read his book, The Age of Spiritual Machines. I guess that was about the year 2000. I got around to reading that, and it was, absolutely blew my mind. And so that was just he was awesome. And I guess as far as what you could take away from that, his vision of how the universe is leading to really to intelligence and greater complexity. It sort of runs at odds of to evolutionary scientists in a way, doesn't it? Your average scientist who is basically saying evolution has no direction. We just
right.
we just happen to be lucky to become intelligent, and it was an adaptation among many, and other adaptations might have been better, but here we got this, and so great, we're the only animals on the planet that can understand how we got here. Ray's saying basically, well, yeah, that may be how we got there, but there's a larger dynamic at play, moving us first. From the organizational principles of chemistry to the organizational principles of DNA and RNA, and then to finally language, and then writing, and then books and computers, and it's all part of a larger picture, as he put it, and that's that is mind blowing, and that was when I first read about it in his Age of Spiritual Machines, he's continued to work on that idea with subsequent books.
Particularly the singularity is near.
Right.
I think that idea, the law of accelerating returns, is one that John Smart kind of helped to flesh out for us
right.
as well, with the notion of the evo-devo way of looking at the universe, because you're absolutely right. An evolutionary scientist, biologist, is going to tell you that evolution is this random movement. It doesn't have an arrow. It doesn't have a goal. It's just happening, right? It's not
right.
trying to make Stephen Gordon the pinnacle of evolution. You're just an amazing
although we'd all agree that that's true, but
it worked out. We got lucky. That's my point. But
yeah.
But actually, no. John Smart, or I should say the evo-devo model, says, yes, evolution is random, but development is not. Development
right.
works towards certain developmental optima, and the Stephen Gordon clearly is one of those. So evolution right, actually is working to that. Now it could have gotten there. It could get to an optima any number of different ways. That's why it's there's still this complete randomness to the process, and it still appears not to be. The evolution part doesn't seem to be going in any particular direction, but once you hit a developmental optima, you're there, and then you start moving up to the next one. So I think I think if the Evo-Devo model pans out, and the law of accelerating return seems to fit nicely into that kind of view of the universe, then the evolutionary biologists have a layer they need to add to how they're looking at how evolution works.
Well, clearly there's at least one more layer they need to add, and that is, you know, I think the age of evolution, you know, may be coming to a close. Not that, you know, evolution won't continue to occur, but it's that it won't be the most important model anymore. You know, instead there'll be, you know, self, you know, we're going to be altering ourselves. We're going to be looking back and saying, okay, we don't like this so much. Thanks, nature, but we can do better is the way we're going to be looking at it from here forward. So age of evolution, I think, is coming to an end.
Well, and there is the one school of thought, the argument, I think Susan Blackmore is her name, who wrote the definitive book on memetics, that actually evolution handed the process of development, the process of change off to information sometime around the time human beings started writing things down. And in fact, information
or
has
maybe even the time we developed the language.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
That handoff has already occurred. Maybe we're already in the post-evolution stage. It's an interesting idea, and I think it does map very well with what Ray was talking about. Well, finally, we come to John Smart's 2 weeks that he spent with us. The interview that was so good, we decided to go ahead and let it run its course and played it out over 2 weeks on acceleration and convergence and human destiny. And I don't know what to add to what we, you know, it's like we've already spent 2 weeks on the past 2 weeks on that. I'm not sure that there's an awful lot to be said. I feel like dovetailing the technological singularity into the Evo-Devo model really kind of rounds the whole thing out.
Absolutely. You know, basically, what we just said. I mean, we can't improve too much on what John Smart said over 2 weeks. So, you know.
No, if we're going to leave with any one thing, it's just that the John agreed with me that the entire evolution of the universe over 15 billion years has actually led up to the iPhone, and that the iPhone is now the precursor of the computer substrate getting smaller, more dense, more compact, until ultimately it all becomes, in the fascinating description he gave us at the end of last week's program, essentially a black hole, a true singularity.
Right.
And
I think it's great that you went out and bought
it altogether.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just think it's great you went out and bought an iPhone right after that show. So.
Well, I don't want to be left out. You know,
yeah,
black hole
yeah.
thing is coming. I figure I need to at least get the
you need to get on board, buddy.
Exactly. All right, Stephen, well, we made it through all 10. I think that was good work on our part. Any closing thoughts on, I'm sure we'll come back and revisit The World Transformed at some point, but any parting?
I suspect we'll come back and revisit some of these issues on a regular basis. It's been a great series.
Yeah, and these things are pretty much what the show is about every week. So.
Yeah, that's just what we talk about. So if you like it, keep tuning in, guys.
Please do continue to tune in. And all right, well, what's our music this evening?
Okay, we got our song is 15 Songs on the Radio. And basically, it's an artist basically saying, you know, it's pretty tough breaking into business when you got 15 songs on the radio. So I believe that we're looking at a future where that's no longer the business model, and you can be successful without necessarily being on, you know, top 40 radio. So
what? His complaint is they only play 15 songs over and over. Is that his idea?
Yeah, pretty much that's it. I mean,
get
XM, you're not
get 150 channels, right? I mean, they're not all pointing.
Yeah, and we're coming. You know, we're entering an era of abundance, and that also means abundance of opportunities to get heard. And so, and I think it's funny we're grabbing his song right off of you know, musicalley.com, and we're playing it. So you know,
there you go. One of the more than 150 songs that we've played over. There you go, 10 times as 15 songs over the course of this program. So perfect. I'm sorry, what was the artist's name again?
His name is, it's the Zach Mack Band.
The Zach Mack Band. All right.
That's right.
Singing 15 songs. Well, thanks, Stephen, for putting that together and for all your contributions this evening. Sally, thanks to you and to all our friends in the chat room, everyone listening live, and to all of you who listen to us via MP3. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We look forward to being with you again next week. And until then, live to see it.
felt fine till I woke up, but the city sucks. Apparently I gotta get out of bed, that's what the clock said. I take a shower and I comb my hair to look like I care. Cops and I'm not.